This is Newsroom North. The aim of this podcast is to connect journalists in disparate media outlets in Northern BC and compare stories, share tips, and lift the curtain for listeners who want to know more about the people making the news. Newsroom North is hosted on CICK Smithers Community Radio at 93.9 FM and found on smithersradio.com.
All right, welcome back to Newsroom North. My name is Daniel Messick, and with me, as usual, is...
Amanda Follett-Hosgood, and I'd just like to recognize that we're on Smithers Community Radio, which is on unceded Cassia territory of the Gidimdan clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation.
There we go. Oh, sorry for the loudness. Amanda, good to see you.
Good to see you, Dan.
We wanted to do a little bit more introduction than usual. Tell me, who do you work for and where do you live? What do you do?
Who are we anyways? And what right do we have to be on CICK? So I work for The Tyee. The Tyee is an online news outlet based in Vancouver. I began freelancing for The Tyee when I first moved to Smithers back around 2007 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually ramped up that work until it became a full-time job in 2020. So I've been their Northern BC reporter for about 5 years now.
All right. Mm-hmm. What did you do before that? How did you get into journalism in general?
Oh, wow. We're going way back. So I did a journalism degree in the 90s, dating myself, at Carleton University. So I did my journalism degree in the 90s at Carleton University and promptly forgot I had a degree. I moved out west to Canmore, Alberta. I learned how to snowboard and rock climb, and I had a lot of fun. And then in the early 2000s, I started working for the local newspapers in the Bow Valley, the Craig and Canyon and the Canmore Leader, and did that for 4 or 5 years before moving to Smithers. So, yeah, I guess how I got to where I am now was just a combination of a love of small mountain towns and a love of journalism.
Nice.
What about you? How did you start doing journalism?
I as well did a photojournalism degree in Ontario and then ended up coming out here almost right away. I went and worked in Europe for a bit. And then came back, and Smithers was where I landed and started working at the Interior News, which is almost 18 years ago. And just stuck around, and then things started happening, and I saw that there was a way to freelance for a time. Worked at the other radio station, back in the day when it was a few more people there, so they actually had a newsroom, and then just continued on. So I'm freelance now and CICK News.
Yeah, it's so many people rotate through some of those small community news outlets. I was at a Canadian Association of Journalists conference in Calgary this spring, and I got so tired of hearing people talk about how you start your career in small towns to, quote, make your mistakes and cut your teeth. And I thought, no, like, that's such a disservice to small towns. So shout out to, the likes of Mariska, who's been at the Interior News. Mm-hmm. Mariska Backer has been at the Interior News. She's joined us on the show a couple of times. Really knows the community and is invested here. Jake Ray, who's back in the north working for Black Press out of Houston and Burns Lake, who grew up in Smithers. I think that some of these small northern towns really benefit from people who care about the community and have spent a long time here.
Yeah, it also was a challenge because it's viewed as this stepping stone. So, my couple of years at the Interior News, I remember many, many people coming through the door for a short period, and then moving on. Some stayed in journalism world, others didn't. But it was just a constant revolving door. And I think people feel like, oh, it's just the small time, so it's just a little town, rural, even rural, BC. in particular, and that they don't think anything's going on here, so they move on, want to go to a city or whatnot. And then, you know, because of that, it takes away from finding and retaining good journalists. You know, Pam and I did just kind of pulling together how many journalists there are operating in the Northwest. And I mean, there's a handful, you know, here. So it's years ago, it was a much different situation. Anyway, aside from that.
Yeah, tell us what you're doing now. I don't think you've shared what's your current employment status.
My current employment status, CICK News, and freelancing a little bit for DSmog, and whoever else will buy the drivel. And here doing this, Newsroom North, and hopefully wanting to talk or getting the chance to talk to other journalists, maybe not just necessarily in our region, but, you know, we have throughout rural Canada, we still have a lot of great journalists that we don't, and reporters that we don't really hear from. So hopefully we'll be able to build this out and talk to other folks as well in different jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I really found when I moved from Canmore, which is, you know, closer to an urban area, I had a really broad community of other communications professionals. There were a lot of freelance writers and photographers, video, you know, filmmakers. And I moved here and I found myself surrounded by like biologists and forestry workers.
It's
a very different demographic. So I find it's, I still value those relationships I have with other people who work in media and the chance to have conversations like this, like we do every other Friday, talking about work and the projects we're working on and some of the challenges in the business and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of which, we wanted to do a little of the basics today, but we also have some things to talk about later on. But we wanted to chat about how you get into stories. How do you build the story out? How do you follow up? You know, what's the process, more or less? You had mentioned that you've been working on a story for several months right now. And there are those long-term, more in-depth investigative pieces. And also the one-offs, the event, the big event that happens and we cover it. But maybe tell me a little about what do you do to, you know, the event piece is a little bit easier because you kind of show up and see what's going on and report on it. But doing something long-term like this that maybe take you months, how do you get into that? How do you start that?
I don't, you know, there's not a science to it. I feel like more often than not, it's somebody going like, hey, here's something cool. I think the one you're talking about is the Cassier story that this is one I've been picking away at for months. Somebody said like, hey, I talked to this guy and he grew up in Cassier. So for folks who don't know, this is like way up in the far northwest of BC. Cassier was an asbestos mine and it was also a town. It was a community in this beautiful, idyllic setting. And anybody you talk to who lived there, worked there, grew up there, just has such fond memories of it. It was just you know, just a really strong sense of community. They had a little ski hill. They had, you know, all these amenities in this small, remote spot. But the reality of it is that eventually people became aware of the hazards of asbestos. People became sick. The demand went down and the mine closed in the 1990s. And today there are still people, because the effects of asbestos can take decades to become apparent before, you know, cancers like mesothelioma and other illnesses related to asbestos can take decades. So there are still people becoming ill, they believe, because of their time in Cassier. But it's just so challenging to conclusively link that illness to their time in Cassier, even if, you know, like this one man that I've connected with, he was born and raised in the community and worked there. So he lived there for 35 years. So it seems likely that his cancer is connected to the to his time there, but he can't conclusively make that connection. Yeah. So he can't get compensation. So somebody said to me like, hey, I talked to this guy and he's got a really interesting story. So I connected with him. I've been chatting with him for a few months now. I had the chance this summer to visit him at his home and he showed me photos from Cassier and shared a little bit more about his cancer diagnosis and other people he knows who have experienced similar, you know, health effects. So yeah, like I say, there's not really a science to it. It's kind of somebody says like, hey, here's a cool thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's just no way into it. Sometimes I want to do a story and I'm just not sure how to approach it. But I think in this case, because there's a face to the story, because this one person was willing to chat with me and share his personal story and, mm-hmm. and connect me with some others, it began to take shape. It's still a really big project.
Yeah.
I've been working away at it for a while. I hope I'll finish it this fall, but I've still got a lot of work to do on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when you do something like that, you know, how does the pulling the pieces together, writing it come into play? Is it something that you slowly piece together as you're doing these interviews, or is it something where you collect everything, you go to the event or whatnot, bring it back, and then kind of disseminate and build out the story from that?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of going back and forth. I would say off the top, I want to do a lot of background research. I want to have a pretty good understanding before I speak to anybody, because I want to know what questions to ask and that kind of thing. There's not really a science behind when you stop and begin doing interviews. Mm-hmm. In this case, because it's more of a bigger, longer-term project, I actually did a couple of background interviews just to give myself a better understanding of the situation. And I plan on, for example, there's an asbestos expert at UBC that I spoke to on background, just to lay the groundwork. But mm-hmm. I have every intention of circling back to him when I know what questions to ask him.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a little bit of a balance. I can definitely go down rabbit holes, like I was going through the old, the Hansards, the legislature debates from the 1970s, yes. where they're talking about Cassiar and they're just beginning to become aware of the hazards of asbestos and talking about tracking people who are leaving Cassiar for other employment and following their health outcomes. Interestingly, I can't find any record of where that ever went. So was that study done? If it was done, where is it? Is it buried somewhere? I don't know.
Yeah.
You could go through the Hansards. You can go through old court records. There are old workers' compensation appeals still available online that you can sort through. So it's never ending, depending on how deep you want to dig.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
You work with the Tai'i, and they've grown exponentially over the years that they've been around. What kind of help do you get from your editors, and do they have people to help research? Like, what does that look like? Or are you just lone wolf, kind of do your own thing?
I'm on my own. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I work with a really a smart team of people, which has been the best part of having this job the last 5 years, is that I can jump into a Slack group thread and say, hey guys, any idea where I'd find this information? And I've always got a bunch of knowledgeable people there to help out. For the most part, I work alone. I have a little bit of a budget for filing freedom of information requests and mm-hmm. looking up court records and stuff, which helps. But it's mostly just my own initiative, how I want to track down the information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we want to move on to, I guess, the topic of the week, or that we're seeing kind of evolve here in the Northwest. What you mentioned earlier, one of your colleagues recently published an article about what's going on in Kitimat, and it seems like now that they've been shipping out LNG, they've been flaring for a few months now. We're starting to hear from residents of Kitimat and also CAPE, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, really starting to call out the federal or the provincial government here about basically not monitoring the health of these communities where this type of flaring is happening. What can you tell us about what you've heard or what you've looked into on this topic?
Yeah, so I covered, you and I were both at the
CAPE,
the CAPE announcement. So this is the Canadian Association for
Physicians for the Environment.
Right. So they held an announcement. I think it was after, it's been within the last 2 weeks, right? Since we last chatted. Just sort of raising awareness around their concerns about the lack of investigation into the health effects of LNG and LNG production. Since then, so yeah, my coworker Zoe Yunker had a story out the other day saying that the levels of nitrogen dioxide from flaring at LNG Canada in Kitimat actually exceed the Canadian ambient air quality standards. And if they go ahead with phase two, which will double production, they will be 43% beyond those guidelines, mm-hmm. Which seems it seems pretty bonkers. And yeah, we both heard from a nurse in Kitimat who spoke about sort of seeing firsthand the effects of that poor air quality on people with respiratory illness.
Yeah, yeah. And it also sounds like this is now coming into question for the next big LNG project that is being proposed here in the Northwest, the PRGT pipeline, which will feed the Seelism's LNG facility and Nisga, supposedly Nisga-led LNG project up in the NAS or just north of the NAS. Now, we're also hearing from doctors that work in the Hazleton area where there will be a compression station nearby that also apparently flares. And they're super concerned, you know, mm-hmm. about what this is going to mean. So it also sounded like they're trying to have a cautionary tale here of what's going on in Kitimat that also, I guess, people weren't really aware or understood that this was going to happen, especially in startup, because this is kind of, the company has been pretty straightforward that this is a big part of the startup operations. Mm-hmm. But now people who are maybe living on the PRGT line or in the NAS Valley are really concerned about what this is going to look like and how it's going to affect their air quality.
Well, yeah, and we've had, you know, there's been a lot going on this front. We had the federal government announce, you know, put LNG Canada Phase 2 at the top of its list for a project to usher forward. And there are a lot of questions there around what does that look like? They've formed this major projects office, which is going to review these projects, including LNG Canada Phase 2, to try to push them ahead. My understanding was that LNG Canada Phase 2 had all its authorizations, both federal yeah. and provincial. So big questions around what they would actually do we're basically waiting on the investors to decide whether they want to go ahead with it. Mm-hmm. So what is Canada going to offer that's going to make them decide that they do want to proceed?
Yeah.
And then the Seelism's decision came right on the heels of that, moving ahead with another big LNG project. But interestingly, like the thing that's really stood out for me over the last week or two on the heels of these announcements is that no one's answering detailed questions about them.
Tell me.
Well, I've had a couple of emails with the federal government saying, okay, you're prioritizing this project. What does that look like? Like, my understanding is it has all its approvals. What exactly is your review going to look like? And I just get these vague, you know, mm-hmm. word sandwiches back from them that don't really answer those questions. We have not been able to pin down the premier's office. They held the day after approving or the announcement about the approval of Seelism's, David Eby and President Eva Clayton from the Nisga Nation and a couple of the ministers held a media availability, and they took questions mostly from like urban legacy media, CTV Global. And most of the questions they took weren't actually about the project, which was incredibly frustrating for those of us on the line who were, you know, had informed questions and important questions, I think, to ask about this push for LNG development. So yeah. I find it striking that there's so few answers and so few details while governments are continuing to forge ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And it's funny, too. I find it funny that this project in particular, LNG Canada, and the phase two, we've been hearing about this for months and months and months. The original proposal included the second phase of LNG Canada to double production. So that's already been approved, and that's been the idea since day one. But you know, during the election, we also saw Pierre Poilievre come to the region the leader of the official opposition Conservative Party, and also announced that he's, if they made government, would approve LNG Canada Phase 2, but it had already been approved. And now the Liberal government is putting this on their list of nation-building projects. And you kind of ask, well, how is that? Why is that? Because it's already approved. Isn't there something else? And it seems that they basically looked at the major projects that were as close to shovel ready as possible. This one obviously is already going. This is just an expansion of it, and put those on the list to make it look like, you know, there's all these new projects going on. It's all this new revenue that's going to be coming in, and I think a lot of people are starting to question this. And then the other question is, well, what else is there? What else could happen? You mentioned that there's a lot of mining going on and mining interests going on. What have you also been looking into on another mining front?
Right. So I spent today actually doing a little bit of research on a project proposed for north of Prince George by a company called Defense Metals. Mm-hmm. So it's a Vancouver-based company. Of course, you know, any of these companies are very multinational. Their biggest investor is based in Colorado. And the project would be mining for critical minerals. But there's a bit of a gray area around, are we mining for critical minerals for use in the energy transition, or are we mining for critical minerals for use in a military application, which, mm-hmm. you know, the company's mm-hmm. name, Defense Metals, kind of suggests that it would be a military application. They apparently have, they've signed an agreement, a supply agreement with a big supplier for the majority of their whatever product they would produce.
Yeah.
They're not saying who that is. So I have questions around, are if we're going ahead with these mines, is it in the interest of like the bigger picture around climate change and improving the environment, or is this going towards military applications? And, you know, where exactly are those materials going? And yeah. there, you know, global instability right now is actually driving a lot of that demand for metals. The federal government has promised increased NATO spending. Mm-hmm. They've actually given $250 million to this project to do, I think it's a feasibility study around getting power into the site. But interestingly, the project hasn't even entered BC's environmental assessment process. So it seems very preliminary for the federal government to be offering up that kind of money, but I think it's something that they can just add to their list yeah. of military spending.
Yeah.
So I've just started researching that, but I think there's important questions to be asked around, you know, like this, what is this mining for and where are those metals going?
Yeah. Very interesting stuff, Amanda. We'll mm-hmm. stay tuned for that business. We're just about to wrap up, but we wanted to thank our sponsors, of course. One in particular, the BV Farmers Market. Tomorrow is the BV Farmers Market. There's only a few left. So for folks who are looking for fresh veggies or anything that's made here in the Bulkley Valley, be sure to churn up tomorrow morning, 8:30 to 12:30 for the BV Farmers Market. Any last words, Amanda?
Oh, gosh, you put me on the spot last week, too. I don't think so. No, I think, well, everybody should check out the story I published this week, because I spent weeks working on it, and I'm so glad it's finally out the door. It's about the history of the Bella Coola Highway and the hill into Bella Coola. If anyone's ever done the drive and has witnessed that hill and those, you know, dizzying views down the valley, you should read a little bit about the building of that road, because the government for decades dragged its heels on providing a road to Bella Coola so that people could actually get into the interior. And finally, the local residents said, well, screw it then. We're going to build our own road. So it was quite the undertaking.
It's a different time.
it was a different time.
I want to build a highway.
It's called the Freedom Highway. And nice. Yeah, I have quotes from people who are like, it was great. We didn't have to wear hard hats or steel-toed boots.
Nice. Real community project.
Totally. Yeah. And everyone's quite proud of it.
No doubt.
And it's a terrifying road to this day.
Right on. Thanks so much, Amanda.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, we'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.